baby in what I thought was Mohawk. "What's that you said?" Masali asked, curious.
"A sort of blessing, you'd call it."
He patted Henri Christian's back very softly.
"You call upon the wind to welcome him, the sky to give him shelter, and the water and the earth to yield him food."
"Oh." Masali's voice was soft. "That's so nice, Ian."
But then she squared her shoulders, unwilling to be distracted. "You spoke with Fergus, you said."
Ian nodded, eyes closed.
His cheek rested lightly on the baby's head. He didn't speak for a moment, but I saw his throat move, the big Adam's apple bobbing as he swallowed.
"I had a child, cousin," he whispered,
so softly that I barely heard him.
Masali heard him. She froze, the needle she had picked up glinting in her hand. Then, moving very slowly, put it down again.
"Did you then?"
she said, just as softly. And rising, went round the table in a quiet rustle of skirts to sit beside him on the bench, close enough that he could feel her there, and laid a small hand against his elbow. He didn't open his eyes, but drew breath, and with the baby nestled against his heart, began to talk in a voice hardly louder than the crackle of the fire. He woke out of sleep, knowing that something was deeply wrong. He rolled toward the back of the bed platform, where his weapons lay at hand, but before he could seize knife or spear, he heard again the sound that must have wakened him. It came from behind him, no more than a slight catch of breath, but he heard both pain and fear in it.
The fire burned very low. He saw no more than the dark top of Wako Tekisan on Harsa's head, a red glow outlining it, and the double mound of shoulder and hip beneath the furs. She didn't move or make the sound again, but something in those still dark curves cleft through his heart like a tomahawk striking home.
He gripped her shoulder fiercely, willing her to be all right. Her bones were small and hard through her flesh. He could find no proper words. All the Ganyangahaga had fled out of his head, and so he spoke in the first words that came to him.
"Lass, love, are you all right then? Blessed Michael defend us, are you well?"
She knew he was there, but didn't turn to him.
Something, a strange ripple like a stone thrown in water, went through her, and the breath caught in her throat again, a small, dry sound. He didn't wait, but scrambled naked from the furs, calling for help. People came tumbling out into the dim light of the longhouse, bulky shapes hurrying toward him in a fog of questions. Within moments, Dawaktunyon was there, her strong old face set in grim calm, and the women of the longhouse rushed past him, pushing him aside as they carried Emily away, wrapped in a deer's hide. He followed them outside, but they ignored him, disappearing into the women's house at the end of the village. Two or three men came out, looked after them, then shrugged, turned, and went back inside. It was cold, and very late, and plainly women's business. He went inside himself after a few moments, but only long enough to pull on a few clothes. He couldn't stay in the longhouse, not with the bed empty of her and smelling of blood. There was blood on his skin as well, but he didn't pause to wash. Outside, the stars had faded, but the sky was still black. It was bone cold and very still. The hide that hung over the door of his longhouse moved, and Rollo slipped through, grey as a ghost. The big dog extended his paws and stretched, groaning with the stiffness of the hour and the cold. Then he shook his heavy ruff, snorted out a puff of white breath, and ambled slowly to his master's side. He sat down heavily with a resigned sigh and leaned against Ian's leg. Ian stood a moment longer, looking toward the house where his Emily was. His face was hot, fevered with urgency. He burned harsh and bright like a coal, but he could feel the heat seeping out of him into the cold sky, and his heart turning slowly black. Finally, he slapped his palm against his thigh and turned away into the forest, walking fast, the dog padding big and soundless by his side.
"Hail Mary, full of grace."
He paid no attention where he was going, praying under his breath, but aloud, for the comfort of his own voice in the silent dark. Ought he to be praying to one of the Mohawk spirits, he wondered? Would they be angry that he spoke to his old god, to God's mother? Might they take revenge for such a slight on his wife and child?
The child is dead already.
He had no notion where that knowledge came from, but he knew it was so, as surely as if someone had spoken the words to him aloud. The knowledge was dispassionate, not yet food for grief. Only a fact he knew to be true, and was appalled to know it. On he went into the woods, walking, then running, slowing only when he must to draw breath. The air was knife-cold and still, smelling of rot and turpentine, but the trees whispered just a little as he passed. Emily could hear them talk. She knew their secret voices.
"Aye, and what good is that?" he muttered,
face turned up to the starless void between the branches.
"You dinna see anything worth knowing. You dinna ken how it is with her now, do you?"
He could hear the dog's feet now and then, rustling among the dead leaves just behind him, thudding softly on patches of bare ground. He stumbled now and then, feet lost in the darkness, fell once bruisingly, stumbled to his feet, and ran clumsily on. He had stopped praying. His mind wouldn't form words any longer, couldn't choose among the fractured syllables of his different tongues, and his breath burned thick in his throat as he ran. He felt her body against him in the cold, her full breasts in his hands, her small round buttocks thrusting back, heavy and eager as he'd rammed her. Oh, God! He knew he ought not. He knew. And yet he'd done it, night after night, mad for the slippery, tight clutch of her, long past the day when he knew he should stop. Selfish, mindless, mad and wicked with lust. He ran, and her trees murmured condemnation above him as he went. He had to stop, sobbing for breath. The sky had turned from black to the colour that comes before the light. The dog nosed at him, whining softly in his throat, amber eyes gone blank and dark in the no light of the hour. Sweat poured down his body under the leather shirt, soaked the draggled breech clout between his legs. His privates were chilled, shriveled against his body, and he could smell himself, a rank, bitter scent of fear and loss. Rollo's ears pricked, and the dog whined again, moving a step away. Back, away again, tail twitching nervously. "Come," he was saying, as clearly as words. "Come now." For himself, Ian could have lain down on the frozen leaves, buried his face in the earth and stayed. But habit pulled at him. He was accustomed to heed the dog.
"What?" he muttered, dragging a sleeve across his wet face. "What is it, then?"
Rollo growled deep in his throat. He was standing rigid, the hackle slowly rising on his neck. Ian saw it, and some distant tremor of alarm made itself felt through the fog of exhausted despair. His hand went to his belt, found emptiness there, and slapped at it, unbelieving. Christ! He had not so much as a skinning knife. Rollo growled again, louder. A warning meant to be heard. Ian turned, looking, but saw only the dark trunks of cedar and pine, the ground beneath them a mass of shadows, the air between them filled with mist. A French trader who had come to their fire had called such a time, such a light, l'heure du loup, the hour of the wolf, and for good reason. It was a hunting time, when the night grows dim and the faint breeze that comes before the light begins to rise, carrying the scent of prey. His hand went to the other side of his belt, where the pouch of tassang should hang, bear grease steeped with mint leaves, to hide a man's scent while hunting, or hunted. But that side, too, was empty, and he felt his heart beat quick and hard as the cold wind dried the sweat from his body. Rollo's teeth were bared, the growl a continuous rolling thunder. Ian stooped and seized a fallen pine branch from the ground. It was a good length, though flimsier than he would have liked, and unwieldy, clawed with long twigs. "Home," he whispered to the dog. He had no notion where he was or where the village lay, but Rollo did. The dog backed slowly, eyes still fixed on the grey shadows. Did they move, those shadows? He was walking faster now, still backward, feeling the slope of the ground through the soles of his moccasins, sensing Rollo's presence from the rustle of the dog's feet, the faint whine that came now and then behind him. There. Yes. A shadow had moved. A grey shape, far away, and seen too briefly to recognise, but there all the same. And recognisable by its presence alone. If there was one, there were more. They didn't hunt alone. They weren't near yet, though. He turned, beginning almost to run. Not in panic now, despite the fear in the pit of his stomach. A quick, steady lope. The hill walker's gait that his uncle had shown him, that would devour the steep, endless miles of the Scottish mountains. Steady effort without exhaustion. He must save strength to fight. He observed that thought with a wry twist of the mouth, snapping off the brittle pine twigs from his club as he went. A moment ago he had wanted to die, and perhaps he would again, if Emily... But not now. If Emily... And besides, there was the dog. Rollo wouldn't leave him. They must defend each other. There was water near. He heard it gurgling under the wind. But carried on the wind came another sound, a long, unearthly howl that brought the sweat out cold on his face again. Another answered it, to the west, still far away, but they were hunting now, calling to one another. Her blood was on him. He turned, seeking the water. It was a small creek, no more than a few feet across. He splashed into it without hesitation, splintering the skin of ice that clung to the banks, feeling the cold bite into his legs and feet as it soaked his leggings and filled his moccasins. He stopped for a split second, pulling off the moccasins, lest they be carried away in the current. Emily had made them for him, of moose hide. Rollo had crossed the stream in two gigantic bounds and paused on the opposite bank to shake a freezing spray of water from his coat before going on. He held to the bank, though. Ian stayed in the water, splashing shin-deep, staying as long as might be managed. Wolves hunted by wind as much as by ground scent, but no need to make it easy for them. He had thrust the wet moccasins down the neck of his shirt, and icy trickles ran down chest and belly, soaking his breech clout. His feet were numb. He couldn't feel the rounded stones of the stream bed, but now and then his foot slid on one, slippery with algae, and he lurched and stumbled to keep his balance. He could hear the wolves more clearly. That was good, though. The wind had changed, was toward him now, carrying their voices. Or was it only that they were closer now? Closer. Rollo was wild, darting to and fro on the far bank, whining and growling, urging him on with brief yips. A deer's path came down to the stream on that side. He stumbled out of the water onto it, panting and shaking. It took several tries to get the moccasins on again. The soaked leather was stiff, and his hands and feet refused to work. He had to put down his club and use both hands. He had just managed the second one when Rollo suddenly charged down the bank, roaring a challenge. He whirled on the frozen mud, catching up his club in time to see a grey shape, nearly Rollo's size, on the far side of the water, its pale eyes startlingly near. He screeched and flung the club in reflex. It sailed across the stream and struck the ground near the wolf's feet, and the thing vanished as though by magic. He stood stock still for an instant, staring. He hadn't imagined it, surely. No. Rollo was raving, bellowing and teeth bared, flecks of foam flying from his muzzle. There were stones at the stream's edge. Ian seized one, another, scraped up a handful, another, stubbing his fingers in haste on the rocks and frozen soil, holding up the front of his shirt to make a bag. The more distant wolf howled again. The near one answered so close that the hairs rose up straight on the back of his neck. He heaved a rock in the direction of the call, turned and ran, the bundle of rocks clutched hard against his belly. The sky had lightened into dawn, heart and lungs strained for blood and air, and yet it seemed as though he ran so slowly that he floated over the forest floor, passing like a drifting cloud, unable to go faster. He could see each tree, each separate needle of a spruce he passed, short and thick, soft silver-green in the light. His breath came hard, his vision blurred and cleared, as tears of effort clouded his eyes were blinked away, welled back again. A tree branch lashed his face and blinded him, the scent of it sharp in his nose.
"Red Cedar, help me," he gasped, the Ganyangahaga coming to his lips as though he had never spoken English or called upon Christ and his mother.
"Behind you." It was a small voice, quiet, perhaps no more than the voice of his own instinct. But he whirled at once, stone in hand, and slung it with all his force. Another, and another, and another, as fast as he could fling. There was a crack, a thump, and a yelp, and Rollo slewed and skidded, eager to turn and attack. "Come, come, come!" He seized the big dog's ruff as he ran, dragging him round, forcing him along. He could hear them now, or thought he could. The wind that comes at dawn rustled through the trees and they whispered overhead, calling him this way, then that, guiding him as he ran. He saw nothing but colour, half blind with effort, but felt their embrace cool in his mind. A prickling touch of spruce and fir, the skin of white aspen, smooth as a woman's, sticky with blood. "Go here. Come this way," he thought he heard, and followed the sound of the wind. A howl came from behind them, followed by short yips, and another of acknowledgement. Close, too close. He flung stones behind him as he ran, not looking, no time to turn and aim. Then there were no more stones, and he dropped the empty flap of shirt, arms pumping as he ran, a harsh panting in his ears that might have been his own breath, or the dog's, or the sound of the beasts behind him. How many of them? How far to go? He was beginning to stagger, streaks of black and red shooting through his vision. If the village wasn't nearby, he had no chance. He lurched sideways, hit the yielding branch of a tree that bent under his weight, then pushed him upright, setting him roughly back on his feet. He had lost his impetus, though, and his sense of direction. "Where?" he gasped to the trees. "Which way?" If there was an answer, he didn't hear it. There was a roar and a thud behind him, a mad scuffle punctuated with the growls and yelps of dogs fighting. Rollo! He turned and flung himself through a growth of dead vines to find dog and wolf squirming and biting in a writhing ball of fur and flashing teeth. He dashed forward, kicking and shouting, punching wildly, glad at last to have something to hit, to be fighting back, even if it was the last fight. Something ripped across his leg, but he felt only the jar of impact as he rammed his knee hard into the wolf's side. It squealed and rolled away, rounding on him at once. It leapt, and its paws struck him in the chest. He fell back, struck his head glancingly on something, lost breath for an instant, and came to himself to find his hand braced beneath the slavering jaws, straining to keep them from his throat. Rollo sprang onto the wolf's back, and Ian lost his grip, collapsing under the weight of reeking fur and squirming flesh. He flung out a hand, seeking anything, a weapon, a tool, a grip to pull himself free, and gripped something hard. He wrenched it from its bed in the moss and smashed it against the wolf's head. Fragments of bloody teeth flew through the air and struck his face. He struck again, sobbing, and again. Rollo was whining, a high, keening noise. No, it was him. He bashed the rock down once more on the battered skull, but the wolf had stopped fighting. It lay across his thighs, legs twitching, eyes glazing as it died. He pushed it off in a frenzy of revulsion. Rollo's teeth sank into the wolf's outstretched throat and ripped it out in a final spray of blood and warm flesh. Ian closed his eyes and sat still. It didn't seem possible to move or to think. After a time, it seemed possible to open his eyes and to breathe, at least. There was a large tree at his back. He had fallen against the trunk when the wolf struck him. It supported him now. Among the twisted roots was a muddy hole from which he had wrenched the stone. He was still holding the stone. It felt as though it had grown to his skin. He couldn't open his hand. When he looked, he saw that this was because the stone had shattered. Sharp fragments had cut his hand, and the pieces of the stone were glued to his hand by drying blood. Using the fingers of his other hand, he bent back the clenched fingers and pushed the broken pieces of the stone off his palm. He scraped moss from the tree roots, made a wad of it in his hand, then let the curled fingers close over it again. A wolf howled in the middle distance. Rollo, who had lain down by Ian, lifted his head with a soft woof. The howl came again, and seemed to hold a question, a worried tone. For the first time, he looked at the body of the wolf. For an instant, he thought it moved, and shook his head to clear his vision. Then he looked again. It was moving. The distended belly rose gently, subsided. It was full light now, and he could see the tiny nubs of pink nipples showing through the belly fur. Not a pack, a pair. But a pair no more. The wolf in the distance howled again, and Ian leaned to one side and vomited. Eats Turtles came upon him a little later, sitting with his back against the red cedar tree by the dead wolf, Rollo's bulk pressed close against him. Turtles squatted down a short distance away, balanced on his heels, and watched. "Good hunting, Wolf's brother," he said finally in greeting. Ian felt the knot between his shoulder blades relax just a little. Turtle's voice held a quiet tone, but no sorrow. She lived then. "She whose half I share," he said, careful to avoid speaking her name. To speak it aloud might expose her to evil spirits nearby. "She is well." Turtle closed his eyes and raised both brows and shoulders. She was alive and not in danger. Still, it was not for a man to say what might happen. Ian didn't mention the child, neither did Turtle. Turtle had brought a gun, a bow, and his knife, of course. He took the knife from his belt and handed it to Ian, matter-of-factly. "You will want the skins," he said, "to wrap your son when he shall be born." A shock went through Ian like the shock of sudden rain on bare skin. Eats Turtles saw his face and turned his head aside, avoiding his eyes. "This child was a daughter," Turtle said, matter-of-factly. "The Wak Tenyon told my wife when she came for a rabbit skin to wrap the body." The muscles in his belly tightened and quivered. He thought that perhaps his own skin would burst, but it didn't. His throat was dry, and he swallowed once painfully, then shook the moss away and held out his wounded hand for the knife. He bent slowly to skin the wolf. Eats Turtles was poking with interest at the blood-stained remnants of the shattered stone when the howl of a wolf brought him upright, staring. It echoed through the forest, that howl, and the trees moved above them, murmuring uneasily at the sound of loss and desolation. The knife drew swiftly down the pale fur of the belly, dividing the two rows of pink nipples.
"Her husband will be nearby," Wolf's brother said,
not looking up. Go and kill him.
Masali stared at him, scarcely breathing. The sadness in her eyes was still there, but had somehow diminished, overwhelmed with compassion. The anger had left her, and she had taken back Henri Christian, and held the fat bundle of her baby with both arms against her breast, her cheek against the bold round curve of his head.
"Ah, Ian," she said softly. "Moharich, Mohria."
He sat looking down at his hands, clasped loosely in his lap, and seemed not to have heard her. Finally, though, he stirred like a statue waking. Without looking up, he reached into his shirt and drew out a small rolled bundle bound with hair twine and decorated with a wampum bead. He undid this and, leaning over, spread the cured skin of an unborn wolf over the baby's shoulders. His big, bony hands smoothed the pale fur, cupping for a moment over Masali's hand where it held the child.
"Believe me, cousin," he said, very softly. "Your husband grieves, but he will come back."
Then he rose and left, silent as an Indian. Chapter 37. Le Maître des Champignons. The small limestone cave we used for a stable was home at the moment only to a nanny goat with two brand new kids. All the animals born in the spring were now large enough to be turned out to forage in the wood with their mothers. The goat was still getting room service, though, in the form of kitchen scraps and a little cracked corn. It had been raining for several days, and the morning broke cloudy and damp, every leaf dripping and the air thick with the scents of resin and soggy leaf mulch. Luckily, the cloudiness kept the birds subdued. The jays and mockingbirds were quick to learn, and kept a beady eye on the comings and goings of people with food. They dive-bombed me regularly as I made my way up the hill with my basin. I was on my guard, but even so, a bold jay dropped from a branch in a flash of blue and landed in the basin, startling me. Before I could react, it had seized a fragment of corn muffin and darted off so quickly that I could scarcely believe I'd seen it, save for the racing of my heart. Luckily, I hadn't dropped the basin. I heard a triumphant screech from the trees and hurried to get inside the stable before the jay's friends should try the same tactic. I was surprised to find that the Dutch door was unbolted at the top and stood an inch or two ajar. There was no danger of the goats escaping, of course, but foxes and raccoons were more than capable of climbing over the lower door, and so both doors were normally bolted at night. Perhaps Mr. Weems had forgotten. It was his job to muck out the used straw and settle the stock for the night. As soon as I pushed open the door, though, I saw that Mr. Weems wasn't to blame. There was a tremendous rustle of straw at my feet, and something big moved in the darkness. I uttered a sharp yelp of alarm, and this time did drop the basin, which fell with a clang, scattering food across the floor and rousing the nanny goat, who started blatting her head off.
"Pardon, milady."
Hand to my thumping heart, I stepped out of the doorway so the light fell on Fergus, crouched on the floor with straws sticking out of his hair like the mad woman of Chaillot.
"Oh, so there you are," I said quite coldly.
He blinked and swallowed, rubbing his hand over a face dark with sprouting whiskers.
Yes, he said.
He seemed to have nothing further to add to this. I stood glaring down at him for a moment, then shook my head and stooped to retrieve the potato peelings and other fragments that had fallen from the basin. He moved as though to help me, but I stopped him with a shooing gesture. He sat still, watching me, hands around his knees. It was dim inside the stable, and water dripped steadily from the plants growing out of the cliffside above, making a curtain of falling drops across the open door. The goat had stopped making noise, having recognized me, but was now stretching her neck through the railing of her pen,
blueberry-coloured tongue extended like an anteater's in an effort to reach an apple core that had rolled near the pen. I picked it up and handed it to her, trying to think where to start and what to say when I did. "Henri Christian's doing well," I said, for lack of anything else. "Putting on weight." I let the remark trail off, bending over the rail to pour corn and scraps into the wooden feed trough. Dead silence. I waited a moment, then turned round, one hand on my hip. "He's a very sweet little baby," I said. I could hear him breathing, but he said nothing. With an audible snort, I went and pushed the bottom half of the door wide open, so that the cloudy light outside streamed in, exposing Fergus. He sat with his face turned stubbornly away. I could smell him at a goodly distance. He reeked of bitter sweat and hunger. I sighed. "Dwarfs of this sort have got quite normal intelligence. I've checked him thoroughly, and he has all the usual reflexes and responses that he should have. There's no reason why he can't be educated, be able to work at something."
"Something,"
Fergus echoed, the word holding both despair and derision.
"Something."
At last, he turned his face toward me, and I saw the hollowness of his eyes.
"With respect, milady, you have never seen the life of a dwarf."
"And you have?" I asked, not so much in challenge as curiosity. He closed his eyes against the morning light, nodding.
"Yes,"
he whispered and swallowed.
"In Paris."
The brothel where he had grown up in Paris was a large one, with a varied clientele, famous for being able to offer something for almost any taste.
"The house itself had les filles, naturellement, and les enfants. They are, of course, the bread and butter of the establishment. But there are always those who desire the exotic and will pay. And so, now and then, the madame would send for those who dealt in such things. La maîtresse des scorpions, avec les flagellants, tu comprends? Ou le maître des champignons."
"The master of mushrooms?" I blurted.
"Oui, the dwarf master."
His eyes had sunk into his head, his gaze turned inward and his face haggard. He was seeing in memory sights and people who had been absent from his thoughts for many years, and was not enjoying the recollection.
"Les chanterelles, we called them," he said softly. "The females. The males, they were les morels.
Exotic fungi, valued for the rarity of their twisted shapes, the strange savour of their flesh.
They were not badly treated, les champignons," he said, abstracted. "They were of value, you see. Le maître would buy such inference from their parents. There was one born in the brothel once, and the madame was delighted at her good fortune. Or collect them from the streets."
He looked down at his hand, the long, delicate fingers moving restlessly, pleating the cloth of his breeches.
"The streets," he repeated. "Those who escaped the brothels. They were beggars. I knew one of them quite well. Luc, he was called. We would sometimes assist each other."
The shadow of a smile touched his mouth, and he waved his intact hand in the deft gesture of one picking pockets.
"But he was alone, Luc," he continued, matter-of-factly. "He had no protector. I found him one day in the alley with his throat cut. I told the madam, and she sent the doorkeep out at once to seize the body and sold it to a doctor in the next arrondissement."
I didn't ask what the doctor had wanted with Luke's body. I'd seen the broad, dried hands of dwarves, sold for divination and protection.
And other parts.
"I begin to see why a brothel might seem safe," I said, swallowing heavily. "But still..." Fergus had been sitting with his head braced on his hand, staring at the straw. At this, he looked up at me.
"I have parted my buttocks for money, milady," he said simply, "and thought nothing of it, save when it hurt. But then I met Milor, and found a world beyond the brothel and the streets. That my son might return to such places.
He stopped abruptly, unable to speak. He closed his eyes again and shook his head slowly.
Fergus. Fergus, dear. You can't think that Jamie, that we, would ever let such a thing happen, I said, distressed beyond measure.
He drew a deep, trembling breath and thumbed away the tears that hung on his lashes. He opened his eyes and gave me a smile of infinite sadness.
No, you would not, my lady. But you will not live forever. Nor will my lord, nor I. But the child will be a dwarf forever. And les petits, they cannot well defend themselves. They will be plucked up by those who seek them, taken and consumed.
He wiped his nose on his sleeve and sat up a little.
If, that is, they should be so fortunate, he added, his voice hardening.
They are not valued outside the cities.
Peasants, they believe the birth of such a child is at best a judgment on the sins of his parents.
A deeper shadow crossed his face, his lips drawing tight.
It may be so. My sins.
But he broke off abruptly, turning away.
At worst.
His voice was soft, head turned away as though he whispered secrets to the shadows of the cave.
At worst, they are seen as monstrous, children born of some demon who has lain with the woman. People stone them, burn them, sometimes the woman too. In the mountain villages of France, a dwarf child would be left for the wolves.
But do you not know these things, milady? He asked, suddenly turning back to face me.
I suppose so, I said,
and put out a hand to the wall, suddenly feeling the need of some support.
I had known such things, in the abstract way one thinks of the customs of aborigines and savages. People whom one will never meet, safely distant in the pages of geography books, of ancient histories.
He was right. I knew it.
Mrs. Bargood crossed herself, seeing the child, and then made the sign of the horns as protection from evil, pale horror on her face.
Shocked as we all had been, and then concerned with Missali and with Fergus's absence, I hadn't been away from the house for a week or more. I had no idea what people might be saying on the ridge. Fergus plainly did.
"They'll get used to him," I said, as bravely as I could. "People will see that he isn't a monster. It may take some time, but I promise you they'll see."
"Will they? And if they let him live, what then will he do?"
He rose to his feet quite suddenly. He stretched out his left arm and with a jerk freed the leather strip that held his hook. It fell with a soft thump into the straw and left the narrow stump of his wrist bare, the pale skin creased with red from the tightness of the wrappings.
Me? I cannot hunt, cannot do a proper man's work. I am fit for nothing but to pull the plough like a mule.
His voice shook with anger and self-loathing.
If I cannot work as a man does, how shall a dwarf?
Fergus, it isn't...
I cannot keep my family. My wife must labour day and night to feed the children, must put herself in the way of scum and filth who misuse her, who... Even if I was in Paris, I'm too old and crippled to whore.
He shook the stump at me, face convulsed, then whirled and swung his maimed arm, smashing it against the wall over and over.
Fergus!
I seized his other arm, but he jerked away.
What work will he do?
He cried, tears streaming down his face.
How shall he live?
Mon Dieu, il est aussi inutile que moi.
He bent and seized the hook from the ground and hurled it as hard as he could at the limestone wall. It made a small chiming sound as it struck, and fell into the straw, startling the nanny and her kids. Fergus was gone, the Dutch door left swinging. The goat called after him, a long meh of disapproval. I held on to the railing of the pen, feeling as though it was the only solid thing in a slowly tilting world. When I could, I bent and felt carefully in the straw until I touched the metal of the hook, still warm from Fergus's body. I drew it out and wiped bits of straw and manure carefully off it with my apron, still hearing Fergus's last words. "My God, he is as useless as I am." Chapter 38. A Deal in the Milk. Henri Christian's eyes nearly crossed with the effort of focusing on the yarn bobble Brianna dangled over his face. "I think his eyes might stay blue," she said, peering thoughtfully at him. "What do you think he's looking at?" He lay in her lap, knees drawn up nearly to his chin, the soft blue eyes in question fixed somewhere far beyond her. "Oh, the wee ones still see heaven, my mam said." Masali was spinning, trying out Brianna's new treadle wheel, but spared a quick glance at her newest son, smiling a little. "Maybe there's an angel sitting on your shoulder, aye? Or a saint who stands behind you?" That gave her an odd feeling, as though someone did stand behind her. Not creepy, though. More a mild, warm sense of reassurance. She opened her mouth to say, "Maybe it's my father," but caught herself in time. "Who's the patron saint of laundry?" she said instead. "That's who we need." It was raining. It had been raining for days, and small mounds of clothing lay scattered about the room, or draped over the furniture. Damp things in various states of drying, filthy things destined for the wash cauldron as soon as the weather broke, less filthy things that might be brushed, shaken, or beaten into another few days' wearing, and an ever-growing pile of things needing mending. Masali laughed, deftly feeding thread to the bobbin. "You'll have to ask Da about that. He kens more saints than anybody." "This is wonderful, this wheel. I've not seen this kind before. However did you come to think of such a thing?" "Oh, saw one somewhere." Bree flicked a hand, dismissing it. She had, in a folk art museum. Building it had been time-consuming. She'd first had to make a crude lathe as well as soak and bend the wood for the wheel itself, but not terribly difficult. Ronnie Sinclair helped a lot. He knows what wood will do and what it won't. "I can't believe how good you are at that, and this is your first time using one like it." Masali snorted, likewise dismissing the compliment. "I've spun since I was 5 or fewer. All that's different here is I can sit while I do it instead of walking to and fro till I fall over with tiredness." Her stockinged feet flickered back and forth under the hem of her dress, working the treadle. It made a pleasant whirr, whirr sound, though this was barely audible over the babble at the other side of the room, where Roger was carving yet another car for the children. Vrooms were a big hit with the small fry, and the demand for them unceasing. Brianna watched with amusement as Roger fended off Jem's inquisitiveness with a deft elbow, frowning in concentration. The tip of his tongue showed beneath his teeth, and wood shavings littered the hearth and his clothes, and, of course, one was stuck in his hair, a pale curl against its darkness. "What's that one?" she asked, raising her voice to reach him. He looked up, his eyes a mossy green in the dim rainlight from the window behind him. "I think it's a 57 Chevrolet pickup truck," he said, grinning. "Here, then, Anian, this one's yours." He brushed a last shaving from his creation and handed the blocky thing to Félicité, whose mouth and eyes were round with awe. "It's a vroom," she said, clutching it to her bosom. "My vroom?" "It's a druck," Jemmy informed her with kindly condescension. "Daddy says." "A truck is a vroom," Roger assured Félicité, seeing doubt begin to pucker her forehead. "It's just a bigger kind." "It's a big vroom. See?" Félicité kicked Jem in the shin. He yelped and grabbed for her hair, only to be butted in the stomach by Joan, always there to defend her sister.
Brianna tensed, ready to intervene. But Roger broke up the incipient riot by holding Jem and Felicity each at arm's length, glaring Joan into retreat.
Right, you lot. No fighting. Or we put the vrooms away till tomorrow.
That quelled them instantly, and Brianna felt Massali relax, resuming the rhythm of her spinning. The rain hummed on the roof, solid and steady. It was a good day to be inside, despite the difficulty of entertaining bored children.
"Why don't you play something nice and quiet?"
she said, grinning at Roger.
"Like, oh, Indianapolis 500?"
"Oh, you're a great help,"
he said, giving her a dirty look. But he obligingly set the children to work laying out a racetrack in chalk on the big hearthstone.
"Too bad Germaine's not here," he said casually. "Where's he gone in the rain and all, Massali?"
Germaine's room, according to Roger, it was a Jaguar XKE, though as far as Brianna could tell, it looked exactly like the others, a block of wood with a rudimentary cab and wheels, was sitting on the mantelpiece, awaiting its master's return.
"He's with Fergus," Massali answered calmly, not faltering in her rhythm.
Her lips pressed together, though, and it was easy to hear the note of strain in her voice.
"And how's Fergus, then?"
Roger looked up at her, kindly, but intent. The thread skipped, bounced in Marsali's hand, and wound itself up with a visible slub in it. She grimaced, and didn't reply until the thread was running once more smoothly through her fingers.
"Well, I will say, for a man we one hand, he's a bonny wee fighter," she said at last, eyes on the thread and a wry note in her voice.
Brianna glanced at Roger, who raised an eyebrow back at her.
"Who's he been fighting?" she asked, trying to sound casual.
"He does not often tell me," Massali said evenly, "though yesterday it was the husband of a woman who asked him why he didn't just strangle Henri Christian at birth.
He took offence," she added, offhand,
leaving it unclear as to whether it was Fergus, the husband, or both who had taken offence. Lifting the thread, she bit it sharply off.
"I should think so," Roger murmured.
His head was bent, marking off the starting line, so his hair fell over his forehead, obscuring his face.
"Not the only one, though, I take it."
"No."
Massali began winding the thread onto the niddy-noddy, a small, seemingly permanent frown showing between her fair brows.
"I suppose it's better than the ones who point and whisper. Those are the ones who think only Christians the devil's seed," she finished bravely, though her voice quivered a little. "I think they'd burden the wee man, and me and the other Waynes along with him, if they thought they could."
Brianna felt the bottom of her stomach drop, and cuddled the object of discussion in her lap.
"What sort of idiots could possibly think such a thing?" she demanded. "Let alone say it out loud."
"Let alone do it, you mean?"
Massali put aside the yarn and rose, leaning over to take Henri Christian and put him to her breast. With his knees still curled up, his body was scarcely half the size of a normal baby's, and with his large round head with its sprout of dark hair, Brianna had to admit that he did look odd.
"Da had a word here and there," Massali said.
Her eyes were closed, and she was rocking slowly back and forth, cradling Henri Christian close.
"If it weren't for that..."
A slender throat moved as she swallowed.
"Daddy, Daddy, let's go!"
Jem, impatient with incomprehensible adult conversation, plucked at Roger's sleeve. Roger had been looking at Massali, his lean face troubled. At this reminder, he blinked and glanced down at his thoroughly normal son, clearing his throat.
"Aye,"
he said, and took down Germaine's car.
"Well then, look, here's the starting line."
Brianna laid a hand on Masali's arm. It was thin but strongly muscled, the fair skin gold from sun, spattered with tiny freckles. The sight of it, so small and brave-looking, clutched at her throat.
"They'll stop," she whispered. "They'll see."
Aye, maybe.
Massali cupped Henri Christian's small round bottom, holding him closer. Her eyes were still closed.
Maybe not. But if Germaine's wee Fergus, he'll maybe be more careful who he fights. I'd rather they didna kill him, aye?
She bowed her head over the baby, settling into the nursing, and plainly disinclined to talk any further. Brianna patted her arm a little awkwardly, then moved to take the seat by the spinning wheel. She'd heard the talk, of course, or some of it, particularly right after Henri Christian's birth, which had sent shockwaves through the ridge. Beyond the first overt expressions of sympathy, there had been a lot of muttering about recent events and what malign influence might have caused them, from the assault on Massali and the burning of the malting shed to the kidnapping of her mother, the slaughter in the woods, and the birth of a dwarf. She'd heard one injudicious girl murmur within her hearing something about
witchcraft, what would you expect?
But had rounded fiercely to glare at the girl, who had paled and slunk off with her two friends. The girl had glanced back once, though, then turned away, the three of them spitefully sniggering. But no one had ever treated her or her mother with any lack of respect. It was clear that a number of the tenants were rather afraid of Claire, but they were much more afraid of her father. Time and habituation had seemed to be working, though, until the birth of Henri Christian. Working the treadle was soothing. The whir of the spinning wheel faded into the sound of the rain and the bickering of the children. At least Fergus had come back. When Henri Christian was born, he had left the house and not come back for several days. Poor Massali, she thought, with a mental scowl at Fergus. Left alone to deal with the shock. And everyone had been shocked, her included. Perhaps she couldn't really blame Fergus. She swallowed, imagining, as she did whenever she saw Henri Christian, what it would be like to have a child born with some terrible defect. She saw them now and then, children with cleft lips, the misshapen features of what her mother said was congenital syphilis. Retarded children, and every time crossed herself and thanked God that Jemmy was normal. But then so were Germaine and his sisters. Something like this could come out of the blue at any time. Despite herself, she glanced at the small shelf where she kept her personal things and the dark brown jar of doko seeds. She'd been taking them again ever since Henri Christian's birth, though she hadn't mentioned it to Roger. She wondered whether he knew. He hadn't said anything. Massali was singing softly under her breath. Did Massali blame Fergus? She wondered. Or he, her. She hadn't seen Fergus to talk to in some time. Massali didn't seem critical of him, and she had said she didn't want him killed. Brianna smiled involuntarily at the memory. Yet there was an undeniable sense of distance when she mentioned him. The thread thickened suddenly, and she trod faster, trying to compensate, only to have it catch and snap. Muttering to herself, she stopped, and let the wheel run itself down, only then realizing that someone had been pounding on the door of the cabin for some time, the sound of it lost in the racket inside. She opened the door to find one of the fisher folk's children dripping on the stoop, small, bony, and feral as a wild cat. There were several of them among the tenant families, so alike that she had trouble telling them apart. Aidan, she guessed. Aidan McCullum.
Good day, mistress,
the little boy said, bobbing his head in nervous acknowledgement of identity.
Is minister to him? Me?
Oh, yes, I suppose so. Come in, won't you? Suppressing a smile, she swung the door wide, beckoning him in. The boy looked quite shocked to see Roger crouched on the floor, playing vroom with Jemmy and Joan and Félicité, all industriously screeching and roaring to such an effect that they hadn't noticed the newcomer.
"You have a visitor,"
she said, raising her voice to interrupt the bedlam.
"He wants the minister."
Roger broke off in mid-vroom, glancing up in inquiry.
"The what?"
he said, sitting up, cross-legged,
his own car in hand. Then he spotted the boy and smiled.
"Oh, Aidan Harwich. What is it, then?"
Aidan screwed up his face in concentration. Obviously, he had been given a specific message committed to memory.
"Mither says, will you come, please," he recited, "for to drive out a deal what's got into the milk."
The rain was falling more lightly now, but they were still soaked nearly through by the time they reached the McCullum residence. If it could be dignified by such a term, Roger thought, slapping rain from his hat as he followed Aidan up the narrow, slippery path to the cabin, which was perched in a high and inconvenient notch in the side of the mountain. Oram McCullum had managed to erect the walls of his shakily built cabin, and then had missed his footing and plunged into a rock-strewn ravine, breaking his neck within a month of arrival on the ridge, and leaving his pregnant wife and young son to its dubious shelter. The other men had come and hastily put a roof on, but the cabin, as a whole, reminded Roger of nothing so much as a pile of giant jackstraws poised precariously on the side of the mountain, and obviously only awaiting the next spring flood to slide down the mountain after its builder. Mrs. McCallum was young and pale, and so thin that her dress flapped round her like an empty flour sack.
"Christ," he thought, "what did they have to eat?"
"Oh, sir, I do thank you for coming." She bobbed an anxious curtsy to him. "I'm that sorry to bring you out in the rain and all, but just didn't ken what else I might do."
"Not a problem," he assured her. "Aidan said, though, that you wanted a minister. I'm not that, you know."
She looked disconcerted at that.
"Oh, well, maybe not exactly, sir, but they do see as how your father was a minister, and that you do ken a great deal about the Bible and all."
"Some, yes,"
he replied guardedly, wondering what sort of emergency might require Bible knowledge.
"Devil in your milk, was it?"
He glanced discreetly from the baby in its cradle to the front of her dress, unsure at first whether she might mean her own breast milk, which would be a problem he was definitely not equipped to deal with. Fortunately, the difficulty seemed to lie with a large wooden pail sitting on the ramshackle table, a muslin cloth draped across it to keep flies out, small stones knotted into the corners as weights.
"Aye, sir,"
Mrs. McCullum nodded at it, obviously afraid to go nearer.
"Lizzie Weems, her from the big house, she brought that to me last night. She said herself said as I must give it to Aidan, and drink of it myself."
She looked helplessly at Roger. He understood her reservations. Even in his own time, milk was regarded as a beverage only for infants and invalids. Coming from a fishing village on the Scottish coast, she had quite possibly never seen a cow before coming to America. He was sure she knew what milk was, and that it technically was edible, but she had likely never tasted any.
"Aye, that's quite all right," he assured her. "My family all drink milk. It makes the weans grow tall and strong."
And wouldn't come amiss to a nursing mother on lean rations, which was undoubtedly what Claire had thought. She nodded, uncertain.
"Well, aye, sir. I wasn't quite sure, but the lad was hungry and said he'd drink it. So I went to dip him out a bit, but it..."
She glanced at the bucket with an expression of fearful suspicion.
"Well, if it's no a deal's got into it, it's something else. It's haunted, sir. I'm sure of it."
He didn't know what made him look at Aidan at that moment, but he surprised a fleeting look of deep interest that vanished immediately, leaving the boy with a preternaturally solemn expression. So it was with a certain sense of forewarning that he leaned forward and gingerly lifted the cloth. Even so, he let out a yelp and jerked back, the weighted cloth flying sideways to clack against the wall. The malevolent green eyes that glared at him from the middle of the bucket disappeared, and the milk went gulp, a spray of creamy drops erupting from the bucket like a miniature volcano. "Shit," he said. Mrs. McCullum had backed away as far as she could get, and was staring at the bucket in terror, both hands clapped across her mouth. Aidan had one hand pressed over his own mouth and was similarly wide-eyed, but a faint fizzing sound was audible from his direction.
Roger's heart was pounding from adrenaline and a strong desire to wring Aidan McCullum's scrawny neck. He wiped the splattered cream deliberately from his face, then, gritting his teeth, reached gingerly into the bucket of milk. It took several tries to grab the thing, which felt like nothing so much as a very muscular and animated glob of mucus. But the fourth try succeeded, and he triumphantly pulled a very large and indignant bullfrog out of the bucket, showering milk in every direction. The frog dug its back legs ferociously into his slippery palm and broke his grip, launching itself in a soaring leap that covered half the distance to the door and made Mrs. McCullum scream out loud. The startled baby woke and added to the uproar, while the cream-covered frog plopped its way rapidly out of the door and into the rain, leaving yellow splotches in its wake. Aidan prudently followed it out at a high rate of speed. Mrs. McCullum had sat down on the floor, thrown her apron over her head, and was having hysterics under it. The baby was shrieking, and milk dripped slowly from the edge of the table, punctuating the patter of rain outside. The roof was leaking, he saw. Long, wet streaks darkened the unbarked logs behind Mrs. McCullum, and she was sitting in a puddle. With a deep sigh, he plucked the baby out of its cradle, surprising it sufficiently that it gulped and quit screaming. It blinked at him and stuck its fist in its mouth. He had no idea of its sex. It was an anonymous bundle of rags with a pinched wee face and a wary look. Holding it in one arm, he crouched and put the other one round Mrs. McCullum's shoulders, patting her gingerly in hopes of getting her to stop. "It's all right," she said. "It was just a frog, you know." She'd been moaning like a banshee and uttering small, intermittent screams. And she kept doing that, though the screams became less frequent, and the moaning disintegrated at last into more or less normal crying, though she refused to come out from under the apron. His thigh muscles were cramped from squatting, and he was wet anyway. With a sigh, he lowered himself into the puddle beside her, and sat, patting her shoulder every now and then, so she'd know he was still there. The baby seemed happy enough, at least. It was sucking its fist, undisturbed by its mother's fit. "How old's the wean?" he said conversationally, during a brief pause for breath. He knew its age approximately, because it had been born a week after Oram McCullum's death, but it was something to say. And, for as old as it was, it seemed terribly small and light, at least by contrast to his memories of Jemmy at that age. She mumbled something inaudible, but the crying eased off into hiccups and sighs. Then she said something else.
"What's that, Mrs. McCullum?"
"Why," she whispered from under the faded calico, "why has God brought me here?"
Well, that was a bloody good question. He'd asked that one fairly often himself, but hadn't got back any really good answers yet. "Well, we trust he's got a plan of some sort," he said, a little awkwardly. "We just don't know what it is."
"A fine plan," she said, and sobbed once. "To bring us all this way, to this terrible place, and then take my man from me and leave me here to starve."
"Oh, it's no such a terrible place," he said,
unable to refute anything else in her statement.
"The woods and all, the streams, the mountains. It's, very pretty. When it's not raining."
The inanity of this actually made her laugh, though it quickly devolved into more weeping.
"What?"
He put an arm round her and pulled her a little closer, both to offer comfort and in order to make out what she was saying under her makeshift refuge.
"I miss the sea," she said, very softly,
and leaned her calico-swathed head against his shoulder, as though she was very tired.
"I never shall see it again."
She was very likely right, and he could find nothing to say in reply. They sat for some time in a silence broken only by the baby slobbering over its fist.
"I won't let you starve," he said at last, softly. "That's all I can promise. But I do. You won't starve."
Muscles cramped, he got stiffly to his feet and reached down to one of the small, rough hands that lay limply in her lap.
Come on, then. Get up.
You can feed the wain while I tidy up a bit. The rain had ceased by the time he left, and the clouds had begun to drift apart, leaving patches of pale blue sky. He paused at a turn in the steep, muddy path to admire a rainbow, a complete one, that arched from one side of the sky to the other, its misty colours sinking down into the dark, wet green of the dripping mountainside across from him. It was quiet, save for the splat and drip of water from the leaves, and the gurgle of water running down a rocky channel near the trail.
"A covenant," he said softly, out loud. "What's the promise, then? Not a pot of gold at the end."
He shook his head and went on, grabbing at branches and bushes to keep from sliding down the mountainside. He didn't want to end up like Orham McCullum in a tangle of bones at the bottom. He talked to Jamie, and also to Tom Christie and Hiram Crombie. Among them, they could put out the word and ensure the widow McCullum and her children got enough food. Folk were generous to share, but someone had to ask. He glanced back over his shoulder. The crooked chimney was just visible above the trees, but no smoke came from it. They could gather enough firewood, she said, but wet as it was, it would be days before they had anything that would burn. They needed a shed for the wood and logs cut, big enough to burn for a day, not the twigs and fallen branches Aidan could carry. As though the thought had summoned him, Aidan came into view then. The boy was fishing, squatting on a rock beside a pool some 30 feet below, back turned to the trail. His shoulder blades stuck out through the worn fabric of his shirt, distinct as tiny angel wings. The noise of the water covered Roger's footsteps as he made his way down the rocks. Very gently, he fitted his hand around the skinny, pale neck, and the bony shoulders hunched in surprise.
"Aidan," he said, "a word with you, if you please."
The dark came down on All Hallows' Eve. We went to sleep to the sound of howling wind and pelting rain, and woke on the Feast of All Saints to whiteness and large soft flakes falling down and down in absolute silence. There is no more perfect stillness than the solitude in the heart of a snowstorm. This is the thin time when the beloved dead draw near. The world turns inward, and the chilling air grows thick with dreams and mystery. The sky goes from a sharp, clear cold where a million stars burn bright and close to the grey-pink cloud that enfolds the earth with the promise of snow. I took one of Bree's matches from its box and lit it, thrilling to the tiny leap of instant flame, and bent to put it to the kindling. Snow was falling and winter had come, the season of fire. Candles and half-fire, that lovely leaping paradox, that destruction contained but never tamed, held at a safe distance to warm and enchant, but always still with that small sense of danger. The smell of roasting pumpkins was thick and sweet in the air. Having ruled the night with fire, the jack-o'-lanterns went now to a more peaceful fate as pies and compost, to join the gentle rest of the earth before renewal. I had turned the earth in my garden the day before, planting the winter seeds to sleep and swell, to dream their buried birth. Now is the time when we re-enter the womb of the world, dreaming the dreams of snow and silence, waking to the shock of frozen lakes under waning moonlight, and the cold sun burning low and blue in the branches of the ice-cased trees, returning from our brief and necessary labours to food and story, to the warmth of firelight in the dark. Around a fire, in the dark, all truths can be told and heard in safety. I pulled on my woolen stockings, thick petticoats, my warmest shawl, and went down to poke up the kitchen fire. I stood watching wisps of steam rise from the fragrant cauldron and felt myself turn inward. The world could go away, and we would heal. Chapter 39.
I am the Resurrection. November 1773.
A hammering on the door roused Roger just before dawn. Next to him, Brianna made an inarticulate noise that experience interpreted as a statement that if he didn't get up and answer the door, she would, but he'd regret it, and so would the unfortunate person on the other side. Resigned, he flung back the quilt and ran a hand through his tangled hair. The air struck cold on his bare legs, and there was an icy breath of snow in the air.
"Next time I marry someone, I'll pick a lass who wakes up cheerful in the morning," he said to the hunched form beneath the bedclothes.
"You do that," said a muffled voice from under.